I want to welcome you to today's edition of The Bradley Hall Show. And I am your host, The Bradley Hall. All right. Hi. As you've guessed it by now, I am The Bradley Hall. I wanted you to know that I am a certified trauma recovery coach and a certified mindfulness instructor and a certified holistic life coach. Now, what this means is that I am a trauma-informed holistic life coach with a focus on awareness, which is the first step to any type of personal growth. Let my 30 years of coaching and my experience overcoming trauma work for you. To work with me, go to my website, thebradleyhall.com. Look for the coaching tab in the upper right-hand corner. You can choose holistic life coaching or trauma recovery coaching. Anyone who ever accomplished anything had a great coach or a great mentor. You should too. You're worth it. Contact me now. Hi, welcome back to today's episode of The Bradley Hall Show. My guest today is an old friend of mine. Her name is Toni Eads. And Toni has agreed to join us to discuss her experience of losing a child to drug addiction. And we're grateful to have her here, and I'd like you to help me welcome Toni. Welcome, Toni.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure. So, you know, I just explained to everyone that we've known each other for a very, very long time.
One very. That makes us old.
One very. Can I say the year?
Oh, yeah, it's totally fine.
Yeah, I think 1983, 84.
Yeah.
Middle school. So,
yeah.
Man, it goes fast, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah. It does. I can't even. I tell my daughter all the time, I was like, you don't understand that I'm still 18 years old. I just look like I'm 50, you know?
So mentally, we're still 18. That's right.
That's right. And so we went to middle school together. And then I moved away and I met someone and I decided to ask her to marry me. And we went to a restaurant, a local favorite restaurant to propose to her. And
smart move, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah.
And it just so happened that you were our waitress the day we were there that I proposed to her and that you happened to be her cousin by marriage.
That's right. Family reunions. I got to see her at family reunions.
Yeah. And we had no idea that you were going to be there. We knew you were her cousin and her and I had talked about you and we showed up and there you were. So you have a unique place in our heart that you were there the day we got engaged.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. So, okay. So again, I'm glad you're here. It's, you know, it's a little bit of a family reunion here, but it's a pretty serious subject. Yeah. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and all of my episodes I'm doing revolve around some type of mental health awareness. And today we're going to talk about addiction and how it's affected you. So I'll just kind of share a little blurb here, and then I'll let you take it from there.
Sure.
You lost your daughter, Marissa, to a drug overdose. How long ago was it?
5 years.
In 5 years, wow.
I know. Sometimes it seems like it's all raw and new and fresh and it just happened. And other times it seems like so long ago.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. And you've agreed to come on today to talk about your experience as a parent with
Marissa's substance abuse, and ultimately what you went through with her overdose, and what you've learned. So you can share that with all of our listeners who may have someone who may be struggling with addiction themselves, maybe struggling with someone, a loved one may have some addiction, or what to look for, you know, if they have children, that kind of thing. So I know it's really hard. I appreciate you being here, and I'll quit talking and I'll let you.
Well, I mean, so basically too, you know, people talk about addiction, and in hindsight, I can tell you what all I've learned and what all I see and what all probably I should have seen when I was going through it with her. You know, but when you're living it, it's one of those things that, you know, you take moment by moment and you put out fire after fire, and you don't really realize how bad it's getting. Whether or not you're it's probably the same story whether you're an addict or you're a loved one of an addict. It's the same story. You know, you just don't realize how fast it can go so far down, you know, honestly. Yeah. You know, in my experience too, a lot of times I explain it like, you know, I feel like, and I've never served. I live in Indiana, so I don't know why this is my analogy, but it is. So getting on a surfboard and just like belly on the board, holding on, and you're just going through the waves. And I felt like Marissa were these waves, and they come crashing down, and then sometimes you were along for a good ride, and then they come crashing down again. And it's just like, you're just holding on. You're holding on for dear life because you don't want to fall off, you know? And, you know, that's just kind of like, that's the road of addiction, whether or not you're the person or the loved one, it's the same road, you know? And I mean, I know I'm jumping ahead and I'll backtrack, but you know, same thing for recovery. People want to think that there's probably an easy fix for recovery, you know, like, oh, they can just go to this rehab, or they can go to this type of counseling, or they can do this. Or some people treat recovery with other drugs, you know, but everybody's story of how they got to where they are is different. So therefore you can't expect everybody's solution to be the same, you know? And as far as, you know, the comparison of drug addiction and mental illness at the time, I mean, my daughter was brilliant, smart, great, witty, beautiful. I mean, I could go on, but, you know, she just had all of these amazing qualities, and she had some pretty cool gifts, you know, about her, you know, gifts like, just the way she was with, and this is weird, but the way she was with older people, little kids, and pets. I mean, like, she was like this, you know, call her a dog whisperer, or an older person whisperer, or, you know, and people with disabilities, you know.
And I always say that, I don't mean to cut you off, but I think it's important, because I always say that you can always tell a lot from a person how they treat older people, little kids, and animals, because they tend to gain nothing from them.
No.
Their authenticity.
Yeah, and that was truly her, you know. It's just that she had all of these great qualities to her. And then of course she had very strong-willed personality too, you know, along with having a big personality comes, stubbornness, you know, she'd make great grades in school, but you can guarantee I was going to get a call from every teacher every year over something, you know? And they all said the same thing. Gosh, she's just so smart and so witty. However, you know, she won't quit talking, or, you know, she's challenging me. She, you know, she wants to debate everything, you know, it's just kind of the way she was. And I always, you know, I always said, even in when she was in grade school, we would have that first parent teacher conference, and it's the same every year. Oh my gosh, she's great. What a great, just model student. And I bet it probably wasn't even a month later is when the phone calls would start. You know, I'm like, she get used to people, and people get used to her, and she, you know, she pushed the envelope no matter what she did. So, but yeah, so with that personality and everything, when things start to happen, and it started happening at 14 with her, she took pain pills out of our cabinets at home. You know, her drug addiction started at home.
Do you think that your influence or was it curiosity?
Oh, total curiosity. We cared for my ex-husband's grandfather who was 85 years old.
Okay.
And so, you know, we had, you know, different medications and pain medications and things like that in the cabinet. And it was kind of, I mean, this is 10 years ago. So the discussions and the openness about addiction and the education and parents talking to other parents, it really wasn't there. I mean, it's no excuse that we should have not had prescription drugs out for, you know, people to be able to get to, but it just wasn't on the forefront of our minds. I mean, it wasn't on, you know, people didn't talk about it, you know? So, but that was the first step. And then of course I went marijuana and, you know, she just kept that. That was just the very first stepping stone. You know, there was that, and then there would be something else. And then she would be hanging out with the wrong people. And then she would sneak out, and then, you know, and then found alcohol, you know, and it just happened so fast after that first moment at 14, you know? And me growing up in the 80s, I did a lot of what she was doing, you know? I mean, I wasn't a perfect kid by any means. And I just chalked it, my only experience I had was me growing up. And so I chalked it up as she's a teenager, you know, she's rebellion. You know, there were some different personal things going on with her, you know, that now I realize was so significant to her journey. But at the time, you know, I thought it was just a teenage girl with low self-esteem and she's rebellion and, you know, she's just kind of being normal. And there was nothing normal about it. You know, the normal was gone before I realized it. And by the age of 17, I was continually searching for rehab and counseling facilities and, you know, just different things that I could get her into to kind of get her on track, because I kept thinking that she's going to grow out of this and, you know, she's going to grow up. You know, by the time I hit 18, I was done with all of it. You know, I was done with the party and I was done with experimenting, you know, whatever it was. I was ready to grow up. And she was just so far gone in her addiction, and it seemed like it just kept, I mean, the true sign a parent can watch for is that when things continually grow, if it's going in the wrong direction rapidly, that's the thing to really pay attention to, you know? So, I mean, not to minimize any drug use, but, or any, you know, kind of inappropriateness from teenagers. But if you see it going from one thing to another, and you know that, you know, it's not just marijuana, you know, and then it's become something bigger, and then it goes from that bigger thing to even a bigger thing, you know what I mean? So those are things like as a parent to really, you know, watch out for. But kind of back to the mental illness. So hindsight now, you know, at the time I lived it, it was, you know, like I said, I used the word normal. Nothing normal about it, but that's what I was envisioning what we were going through. Looking back now and learning all that I've learned from all the people that are affected by addiction, and by learning from counselors and doctors and things like that, is that there was mental illness there with her. You know, even though she seemed perfectly normal, you know. And she was the kid that, you know, she'd light up the room when she walked in. You know, she was the life of the party, you know, at a very young age. You knew she was there. She wanted you to know she was there. You know, that's just Marissa. But, you know, with that, too, is that she was so smart. Her mind was constantly thinking and racing. And I remember one point she was reading 8 books at the same time. Very, very intelligent books, you know, and it's just the way her mind worked. And so a lot of times too, I realized now that she was using some drugs to kind of slow her brain down and ease her mind and ease her anxiety that she had, because she just didn't stop, you know? So that was part of it, was her intellect, you know.
Did you hear about what was going on inside her head? Was she aware?
You cut out just a little bit. What did you say?
I'm sorry. Did you two discuss what was going on inside her head? Was she aware that her mind was racing to this level, or was she just adapted to it and she was just living her life? And now that you look back, you see that.
Yeah, no, at the time it was just, she was living her life and, you know, with no really awareness of self-awareness.
She's pretty typical for a teenager, right? I mean,
right.
You know, yeah, I wasn't even aware until my 30s. So,
right. Yeah. And then, and you know, she would isolate from the good influences she had in her life and she would migrate to the bad. I mean, so if it was a bad person making bad decisions, you guarantee that that's who she was drawn to, you know. It was like she was drawn to the excitement of it, you know. The other part of it too is she has a biological father who I divorced when she was two. And we had no contact with him for many, many, many years. And there was a good reason. A lot of it was fear on my part. And a lot of it was, I mean, there were many times that I have restraining orders against him just because of his extreme behaviors. Mm-hmm. And he was in and out of jail, things like that. So he went a really bad route right after we got married. And so I divorced and we stayed separated. But anyway, I ended up moving her away to Florida, sunny Florida, Brad. Mm-hmm. When I moved back, and by then he had already signed off all of his rights, things like that. So totally disengaged from any kind of relationship with him, but found out many years later, Marissa was about 16, and I had found out that he was in prison, and he would go back and forth between prison and mental institutions for his mental illness. And I didn't know why, and I didn't know what the story was, but Marissa seeked out his family and found out that it was schizophrenia.
Okay.
So he was diagnosed with schizophrenia in his late 20s, early 30s. And so he had addiction problems and the mental illness. And he could just never overcome it. So, you know, we found that out and a lot started to kind of make sense with Marissa. And I had two different doctors. Well, I had a doctor and a counselor both tell me when she was 17 years old that she had borderline personality disorder. And a lot of times that doesn't come out until you're in your late teens, early 20s. That's not something that's diagnosed at a young age. So, you know, not realizing it and thinking she was just like this normal average kid, you know, there was underlying things going on that I had no idea, you know. And most likely knowing those things, you know, I would have handled the severity of her issues at 14 a way different way, you know, instead of, I mean, honestly, I minimized it. I completely minimized what she was going through until it was too far gone, yeah. You know.
Now, when you found out that there was a family history of mental illness and that mm-hmm. applied to Marissa, Did that make it easier or did that make it harder or was it just different?
I think it's indifferent. And the reason I say that is by then she was almost 18 and anybody that I tried to get help for her, I couldn't. She had to get help for herself and she didn't want it. You know, she didn't see anything wrong. And her famous phrase to me was, "I don't need fixed. Stop trying to fix me." And I used to tell her, "I'm not trying to fix you. This is above my realm of being able to help you, not fix you, but help you. And I don't have the education or the background to know what to do. So let's go find these resources of people that can." And she just didn't want anything to do with it. There were a couple times that I took her to different facilities and she would go in the intake, you know, is what it's called when you first get to these different type of, whether it's counseling or rehabilitation, you go into intake and they take down all your information and ask you all those questions. Well, she was smart enough to figure out exactly what to say for them to think she was totally fine, and they would release her every time. And they're like, she's fine. At 14, she's just rebelling, you know, she's trying to find herself, she'll be fine, you know. And I kept saying, no, she's not, but it didn't matter what I said. By the time you hit a certain age, you're no longer really considered a kid. At 17 and 18 years old, you're not a kid, you know, and there are no parental rights. I mean, I couldn't force her into any of these facilities. She was forced into one. I think she was 19. She had gotten in trouble with the police officer, and she was sent to a hospital. And from the hospital, they told her the only way they would release her is if they sent her to a rehabilitation center. So she did that for a while. So it's not like she never tried, because she did. And she would digress, you know. But there were many times that she really did, and she would have clarity, and she would say, I want to get better. I want to feel better. I'm over this. And she would go to meetings and, you know, do a lot of stuff. And at that point, it was a combination of alcohol, marijuana, you know, she was doing meth. It was a combination of all of those things that she knew she needed to stop doing. And I'd say at 19 was the most I saw her where it seemed like she was going down a better road, and then she'd slip, and then she'd try again, you know. So it was no longer me making her go to these places. It was her. Sometimes she would, and sometimes she wouldn't, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And it illustrates the helplessness that an addict goes through. That their behavior is really driven by the disease. And I know people who can't identify, can't understand, and rightfully so, because we only know what we know through our own experiences. But a lot of people just think, well, they made the decision to start. They're making the decision every time they do it. They should just stop. They should just quit. And here you are telling me that your daughter kept trying, that she kept trying, and she kept trying. Yeah. And couldn't get a foothold on it. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, she would acknowledge it. You know, she acknowledged the fact that, you know, well, I would say she would acknowledge. She would acknowledge it at moments. But then if she was in a bad place, or if I knew she was using, there was no acknowledgement whatsoever. I was a horrible person. How dare me not support her, you know, things like that. And after that many years of loving an addict and adapting to their ways and their manipulation and their stories, and I mean, there's such a trust factor that is so far gone after so many stories, you know. And you know, you come to adapt to just how you react to them, because there's no proactiveness whatsoever, you know. And I truly feel that she knew, I was there for her no matter what. Now, if she called me to get her out of jail, I would not. If she called me for money, I would not. But I would find other ways to constantly remind her and let her know that I was there, you know, regardless if she wanted me to be there or not. You know, she would, you know, be on a frenzy of not speaking to me, and, you know, I'm a horrible person for not doing something for her that she wanted done, and it didn't matter. I'd still send her a text. I'd still give her a call. You know, that's just what you do.
Right.
You know.
Right. So do you feel, I'm going to ask you a pretty tough question.
Okay.
Do you, and you can talk about the expanse of your experience from going through this period to her overdose to where you're sitting right now. How has your thoughts changed about, I mean, at times, did you feel guilty, like you failed her? Did you feel like it was your
fault? Oh, gosh.
Absolutely. That's run the gamut, I'm sure, back and forth.
Yeah, absolutely. there's so much guilt from, I mean, one, I think even from spouses that love addicts and go through it, but from a parent standpoint, you are supposed to fix everything. You're supposed to make everything better, you know? They fall and get hurt, fix it. And this is something that I couldn't fix. No, sorry.
No,
this is, it's something that I couldn't find a band-aid. I couldn't find the right words, the right way, you know, to make it better. So there's a lot of guilt. I even had a friend tell me at one point throughout all of this and this journey with her is, why do you feel so guilty? Like she is pushing the guilt on you. You don't need to do it too, you know? So she's pushing the guilt on you and you're pushing the guilt on you. But I mean, it's human nature. Yeah, I mean, how can you not? I think any parent, you know, and I have a son that's 19 now, and you know, you question every piece of advice you give them. You question every reaction with them as a parent to know, you know, am I doing the right thing? Am I being strict enough? Am I being too strict? I mean, like, I just don't think you're a good parent unless you're doubting and questioning everything you're doing. You know?
I say all the time about parenting is the thing that really sucks about parenting is that none of us know how well we did until it's too late.
Right.
You just make, yeah. It doesn't matter how many kids you have. I mean, if you have 15, you're probably better with the 15th than you were with the first, but you
probably,
right. But
yeah,
the personalities are different. So every day is a reaction. You're making it up as you go. You're learning as a parent. And then they get to a certain age and you just hold your breath and hope that it works. It's a hard reality as a parent. And you know that I have two older ones and I have a younger one. So, Zach is 30 and Tyler's 27 and Malia's 16. And one of the greatest things I learned with the oldest ones was that they're their own person. And that all the worrying I did when they were younger was for naught, because they were still doing things they wanted to do and things that I didn't approve of, because that's what people do. That's what I did as a teenager, it's what you did as a teenager, it's what they did as a teenager. And so one of the hardest things for me to admit, even though I was probably at one point one of the two greatest influences in their life, and I'd like to still think that I am, I still have to realize that my influence on them wasn't as great as I thought it was at one time. And yeah. That they're their own people, and they're going to, as their responsibility increases, then you know, their locus of control increases, their responsibility increases, and they're responsible for their own decisions. Have you been able to accept that part of it and move beyond the guilt a little bit and
I don't know if there's such a word of accepting it. Maybe it's not as much in the forefront of my mind as it was in the very beginning. I would have to say even the guilt was even stronger as we were living it and we were living her addiction together. My yeah. guilt was like crazy strong then. And then after she passed away, of course it was there. I mean, there's no doubt, you know, that it was there. But then, you know, you self-reflect and you think a lot and you think a lot about that past and you think about everything you did. And, you know, you do the best with what you have at that time. You know, with all the information that's around you, you're making decisions with the utmost depths of your heart with the good intentions of making things better. And I guess that helps with guilt, knowing that I never did anything selfishly. You know, I never once was selfish through any of that journey. It was all about her, you know, it was all about, you know, what do we need to do to make this better? You know, whether I had the tools and the knowledge to do it, I didn't, you know. So there was always guilt in, you know, not talking about it more and not researching and digging into it more. But I think because at that time of when it was starting, before it hit that escalation point of, oh my gosh, I can't do anything. You know, at that time, I didn't look at it like a disease and addiction and mental illness. I didn't look at any of that like that, you know? like I said, you're living moment to moment and grounding after grounding, or, you know, you're just kind of dealing with each issue as they come up, you know, best you can. So yeah, I'd say probably the guilt has gotten less. Not that it's gone, not that it'll ever be gone. I don't expect it to be. So I think the biggest thing that I learned through, you know, all of this is that whole judgment, you know, and I think that's what so many people, when they think about drug addiction or alcoholism, things like that, is that judgment that people have. You know, they judge, well, how were they brought up? You know, what's their family like, or where'd they come from, or where did that parent go wrong? You know, and I think that's like a gut reaction that so many people have. That I have learned so much since she passed. Well, I learned a lot before she passed, just didn't recognize it until after. Yeah. But so like, it's just such a common thing for people. And that's why I put videos out. And in those videos, one of the first things I say is just like, close your eyes and picture a drug addict, you know? Yeah. And when you picture that image, you know, what are people really looking at the time that I did the videos? I would think that people are picturing someone that's not a beautiful 5 foot 300-pound girl, you know, which was Marissa.
Yeah.
Now I think if people close their eyes and they picture an addict, sadly enough, they can probably picture somebody they're close to or know, or family member, you know, because it's just so common, you know. It wasn't, but it's become that way. So I think now when people close their eyes and they picture an addict, they probably are picturing somebody that they know that's an addict.
Yeah.
Which is
bad. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I know when I was on the fire department, and that I probably ran on 10 overdoses in the small town that I lived in 10 years. Doesn't seem like a lot, but I'm working only every third day with you know, days off, and in between two houses, and you know, there's at any time there's three or four different apparatus running. And I got one a year on average for about 10 years. That's pretty remarkable in the small town that I was living in.
Yeah.
It's a real problem. And I guess we don't need to convince anyone, because anyone who's alive now, 5 to 10 years ago, this would have been a different conversation. But anybody's alive now and doesn't know that there's an addiction problem, hasn't been paying attention.
Right. Yep. I agree. But that whole judgment thing, you know, what I learned, or what I reflect on from Marissa, and I knew this was her all growing up, kind of back to how she had such a gift with, you know, people, children, elderly, disabled. And the reason she had this gift is because she did not see flaws. Never, ever. It was not in her nature. It wasn't in her makeup. It wasn't anything about her that would see someone's flaw. She would see the good immediately. And, you know, that judgmental part, it's just so sad, because then, of course, she dies in such a bad way, and you know there's judgment, and it's like, oh, of all people, you know, don't judge her, you know.
Yeah.
It's just so sad that that's just the way people are. And I've tried, I don't do it as much as I did before, but, you know, I just try to educate people and communicate and put stuff out on social media or videos or whatever it is, just about that judgment. You know, you never know what somebody has experienced and where they're coming from. And like you said earlier, it's not like they have a choice. People, they still do. This is nothing that went away. But people don't necessarily have a choice to stop. They want to stop. They can't. They have, you know, whatever it is they're going through. And I think that's most people's judgment of addiction, is that they're making choices, you know?
And they do have a choice.
Mm-hmm. We froze up. Can you hear me? Can hear me? Can you hear me now?
You back?
Oh, I'm back.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So they do have a choice, but people don't understand that how incredibly difficult of a choice that is. And it's just not, you know, an easy choice of whether you're going to have orange juice or not for breakfast. It's not that simple. There's a whole lot of behavioral patterns that go behind it that go into that. Has anyone accused you, judged you with this personally, or is this just something that you feel from your experience beforehand, hearing other people talk about other people, or have you had an incident where someone has judged you?
No, I think I just hear it more generally. People have a lot of compassion towards me. I mean, just the support and amazing support I get from everyone, it has always been great. Now, what I normally see is when people don't know my story and people will say things, you know, or even when people do know my story and they forget, or they forget how she passed away or things like that, and they make very nonchalant, you know, comments, or, I mean, people make very stupid comments about, oh, druggies, or, oh, they must be on drugs. The common one is, oh, what are you on, drugs? Yeah. You know, I mean, so, but here, and I think I've had this from day one, is that I don't get mad at anybody for misspeaking. Never have. I never will. And my theory on it is that I'm glad they don't know what I know. I'm glad they don't feel what I feel. And I'm glad that they have the ignorance to say things like that and not the knowledge and experience that I have. So I would never get mad at, you know, anyone for saying anything. I know I was in a situation, it was actually, surprisingly enough, it was a baby shower, and somebody had made a comment about drug addicts and it was very inappropriate comment. I didn't say anything, nor was I going to, but two other people spoke up on my behalf and put this gal in her place. And, you know, a year or so later after that, she came to me, just apologized. I'm like, I'm glad you're ignorant. You know, I really am. You know?
Yeah. But it's good that she also, I mean, this is how we grow, right? I mean, she didn't know, ignorance is bliss, that whole thing. She pops off with a comment that is socially acceptable among her friends. Someone sets her straight. She has time to think about it, and she understands the impact. And she comes to you and apologizes, and everybody grows from the experience. That's the way life is supposed to work, right?
Right. That is right. Yeah. Absolutely.
Did you hear that?
I did.
I don't know what that was.
I don't know what it was. I don't know. I don't think it was mine. I don't know.
So you touched a little bit on the grieving process, but do you have anything else you want to say about the grieving process?
I do. Hang on, I just lost you. Hang on. Okay. It's hard. It doesn't ever go away. I tell everybody. Sorry.
No.
There's a hole in my heart, and it'll never be mended, you know. It'll never get better. It doesn't go away. The best you can do is to just adapt, you know. They say this too. There's so many different phases of grief. For the most part, I don't normally do this. I do sometimes, you know, when I'm talking about her, when it's talking about something important. I used to get up and speak to people, and I couldn't get my words out, you know, very early on. I couldn't articulate what I wanted to say. I felt like, I just, you know, some smart man told me that I had a platform and that I needed to be using it. And it just resonated with me so great. And I was out there and I was trying to do different speeches and touch different people and through my experience, you know. And so I decided to put videos together because I couldn't get everything out that I wanted to get out. So if I put it in an outline and I do it, you know, methodically, and I do it in a video, then I'm able to just show the videos and get out her story like I wanted to. And when you contacted me, gosh, I mean, how many years ago was that? Probably almost 4 years ago. And you had sent me a Facebook Messenger about it. And you're like, you really need to be doing something, you know? And I just told you, I'm like, I'm having a hard time wrapping my brain around what this video would look like. And you said, well, why do it in one video? You know, there are so many layers to this journey. You know, there's so many layers to addiction. There's so many layers to mental illness. There's so many layers to grief, you know, the whole thing. And so I did, I broke it down and I did about 5 videos. One just breaking that down, just like telling her story, you know, kind of like the overview of her story. Another one was a focus towards parents of, you know, talk to other parents, you know, this isn't anything to be ashamed of, and you need help and you need comfort and you need resources and do some digging, you know, look into things. You know, don't think not my child, don't think they're just rebelling, you know, pay attention to some of those signs. And then of course we did a video to teenagers, you know, the same thing, you know, that teenagers need to kind of look out for one another. If you see a friend going down the wrong path, help straighten them up, you know, don't go down the path with them because it's the easy thing to do. What's better for them is for you to tell them when they're wrong, you know, or stand up for what you truly don't want to do and things like that. You know, so, and then another video on, you know, just judgment, you know, just being judgmental and, you know, try to find the good in people. And if somebody is struggling, that doesn't mean that you can't be support for them. You know, people find support in the strangest places. It's not always that closest person to them. It could be a complete stranger, you know? So there are so many layers to it. There's so many layers to grief. I go through phases, you know, of course. I do my very best to stay strong for my son and my family. Like I always say, I didn't lose Marissa. We all lost her, you know? We have a big close family. So, you know, she was extremely close to all of her cousins and all of my cousins even, and brothers and sister and, you know, her grandparents and, you know, we all lost her. So when I do things in honor of her, you know, I try to stay strong for everybody else. And I think that's my own coping mechanism, you know, most of the time. When I have bad days, it's usually when I'm by myself, and I know it's necessary. I know it's needed. It's part of the process is to be sad and cry all day or whatever you need to do, you know?
Everybody, a good cry is completely underappreciated by everyone. It's very, very, very therapeutic. Like you have no control over what's going on, and you know, no one wants to let it go, but I didn't mean to cut you off, but I'd circled that on some of the things we talked about, and I wanted to make a point that crying is okay. It's more than okay. It's the body's response, the body's way of healing and getting
to it. As much as I try to contain it and control it, you know, it doesn't always happen, and that's okay, you know. And I think I told you this, is that, you know, same thing as that ignorant is bliss. You know, people don't know what to say to someone that has been through such a tragedy. People don't, they just don't, you know? And, you know, people will always say, are you okay? You know, are you doing okay? Especially, you know, right after. And it's like, it's a silly thing to say. Of course I'm not, you know? But I quickly figured out my response of, it's okay, but it's not, or I'm okay, but I'm not okay. But that's okay, you know. It's exactly where I'm supposed to be. I'm not supposed to be okay. I am supposed to grieve. I am supposed to cry. I am supposed to not want to get out of bed sometimes, you know. But you know, I force myself to do it, and I think a big part of that too is TJ. You know, especially because he was younger and he was in middle school, and you know, I had to get up and be strong and do and be, and that was probably the best thing for me anyway, you know? So, but it hits you hard at times, you know. I was working out at Orange Theory, and as ludicrous song of all songs, the ludicrous song came on, and I lost it. And I mean, the coach saw me and thought I had an injury, and it's like, no, the song, you know. I mean, I just couldn't function, couldn't move, couldn't do anything, you know, just couldn't talk, couldn't explain exactly what was wrong with me. But it hits you really hard, you know. But then you go through it, and then you move on, you know. And then, not move on, but you know what I mean, you contain yourself, control your emotions, and, you know, keep pushing forward.
Yeah. Do you think telling Marissa's story, you think the videos that you did and telling her story, do you think that helped the grieving process? Do you think it helped normalize it to the point to kind of bring you down a little bit?
Oh, it helped me tremendously. You know, and I would, like, just like this, doing things like this and getting emotional and getting upset. And, you know, I've had people say, is that good for you? You know, don't do it if you're going to get upset about it. But no, it is good. It's good for me, regardless of what my emotions come out. It's all, I mean, one, I just absolutely love talking about her, you know. So, but then, you know, going through and doing all those videos, it was therapeutic. I always felt like she was going to overcome what she was going through. And because she had such a gift with people, like, she could read people like crazy. And she just had such a gift that I could see her standing in front of in a gymnasium at a school. And she would be so relatable because she was so cute and tiny and small. And, you know, she wasn't going to get much bigger than she was. And I could just see all these teenagers really relating to her and her telling her story of her overcoming and, you know, going down a bad route, but then pulling it back. And I could see her affecting people in such a strong, amazing way. And that never happened. And so I kind of felt like through me, I needed to get her story out, you know, and through me, I had to try to make a difference in other people's lives. And I always said, you know, it doesn't matter how hard this is on me, as long as it affects one person, that's all that matters. You know, one, if it changed one person's life, that was the key, you know. If it stopped another parent from not having to go through what I go through every day,
then it matters.
Well,
you know? I think it's very brave of you to do that. I know, because of what I've been through personally, and, you know, I'm a trauma recovery coach, and the episode before you, I was another trauma recovery coach who's been through some trauma, and we were both talking about, I'm a firm believer in that the more you tell your story, no matter what it is, the more you tell your story, the more it normalizes it. You know, we're all fighting a battle we can't see. This even goes into I have another theory that everyone's addicted to something, and that will start a fight in a room full of psychologists, I promise you. But it doesn't matter whether it's drugs, alcohol, TV, porn, food, it doesn't matter. Work, you know, workaholics, you know, even if it's just reading, that you're addicted to reading and you can't get enough of it. We all have behavioral processes. We're all not normal. And one of the things in the trauma community is they're very sensitive about the word broken, that they don't like to say anyone's broken. And I like to kind of twist that a little bit and say, no, we're all broken. And because we're all broken, we're all normal. And if we could all begin to understand that we all have our issues that we're working through, have a little more acceptance and understanding and not be so judgmental like you were talking about earlier, have a little more compassion, then we could all help each other a little bit. And get beyond this. So, man, I forgot my point again. I forgot what I was saying.
I don't know, but it was all great. Because, I mean, it really is. And a lot of things that I've put out there, too, with Marissa is less judgment, more compassion. That's really, you know, that's what everybody should live by, you know. I mean, it's like life 101. But why do we get so far away from that? You know, why is it our first thoughts go negative and our first judgments go negative, you know, instead of always trying to find the good in people? And like you said, you know, everybody's addicted to something and everybody's going through something, you know? So, you know, getting out there and talking about it, it makes you not feel alone. It makes people, hopefully, you know, it makes people not feel like they're the only ones going through something and that maybe they're kind of okay or they could be okay, you know?
Yeah. So, I think especially with mental health and mental illness, I think everybody's ego is trying to convince ourselves that we're not screwed up because we think nobody else is screwed up. So when we think someone is screwed up, that they're the exception rather than the rule. And, right. You know, talking about it, normalize it. We could all talk about it, get it all out there and normalize that. And we could all begin to understand it. Just, it goes a long way. And telling your story is so therapeutic. That's where I was going a minute ago. Telling your story is so therapeutic. The more you tell, I just can't emphasize that enough. The more you tell it and get it out, the more you educate people and the more you begin to understand yourself. And it sounds like that, you know, telling Marissa's story has done that for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to jump in here and say that you gave me a list of the links for the videos that you did. Mm-hmm. I'm going to, we'll probably, on the video version of this, we'll put it in the video right here. For those listening on the audio podcast, please go to my website, www.thebradleyhall.com. And I will put a slash blog, and I will put a blog entry on there with a couple excerpts, probably what we're doing here. And I'll put all the links to the YouTube videos that you made so people can check those out.
Yeah, if anything else, you can go on there and check out and how stinking cute and beautiful my girl is.
Well, we're gonna drop a picture in here on the video side of things too to highlight.
Oh, awesome.
We're kind of moving towards the end here. It sounds cliche, but I don't think it is at all. I think it's important. What would you like people to know? What would you like people? I mean, I guess we're looking at parents or someone who has a loved one in that, and we're looking at kids, you know, young people that maybe dealing with some mental health issues on their own that think that that they're an exception. You know, I remember being in middle school and high school and having, you know, just being terrified that people were going to find out certain things about me.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone goes through that. What kind of advice do you have for people?
Well, and I think like just judging or basing it off of my experience with Marissa and her constant comments of, stop trying to fix me. And it was never about trying to make her anything other than what she was. What she was amazing, like off the charts amazing in so many different ways. What it was helping guide her to an easier life, you know, guiding her to more self-gratification instead of a struggle. I mean, struggling is not fun.
To steer her away from destruction, which is what ultimately she met. And
yeah. And it's just like, it's not about trying to fix somebody, you know, it really isn't. It's about helping them grow into the person that they are and take away all the clutter, you know, take away all that other stuff that's nonsense, you know. And I mean, there's nothing wrong with talking to parents, talking to friends, going to counseling. There is nothing wrong with any of those things. You know, and I think that kids look at it like, oh my gosh, you know, like you said, like, I don't want to tell anybody anything, you know, but I mean, what would it hurt if you did go talk to one of your very dear friends or if you did go talk to a parent, you know, I don't think it's going to hurt anything. I think you'll realize that people are more understanding than what you think, yeah. You know,
yeah. And the thing with kids. Normalizes it like we talked about. It doesn't matter if you're talking to a friend or a parent or a therapist. That's what therapists get paid to do. That's what as a trauma coach, mine's a little different. I help design, you know, goals and look beyond, but I also listen, and having someone to listen to you again helps you tell your story and normalize. And
yeah, I mean, and the whole things with drugs and addiction, you know, I tell kids the best way to know that you can never become an addict is to never even try it, you know?
Yeah.
You don't know what your genetic makeup is. You don't know if there's some underlying issues going on with you that, you know, people think, oh, I could just try it. I can be in control. Most kids think they could be in control of whatever it is that they're doing wrong. And that's not the case at all, you know, so it could get out of hand really quick. And the best way to do that is to prevent it altogether, you know? Yeah.
It's so hard for a kid though, when they see someone in their school, you know, taking some kind of drugs, whether it's, you know, cocaine, meth or heroin, whatever. And they see them, they know they're doing it and they're coming back to school and they look normal and they're still popular or whatever. So when an adult tells them, I remember being that age and thinking when an adult would tell me, you know, drugs are going to hurt you, they're going to kill you, thinking you have no idea what you're talking about because I go to school with all these people and that's all they do. It's hard to really connect that because you don't have enough life experience, but, you know. Well,
and you know what? Another thing too, is I always tell people, like, I would put these videos out there and I'm like, show them to your kids. It's not you telling your kid what not to do. It's somebody else. You know, let somebody else be that guidance or put plant that seed, you know. And the thing about it is talk. I mean, like parents, just like sex education, parents don't want to talk about it with their kids. But the more you talk about it, the easier it is. Same thing with drugs and alcohol. The more you talk about it, then the more open your kid is going to think that they can be talking to you about it. And I just remember, you know, mine was that house, you know, with my son and all of his friends, always had a house full of kids. And I never hesitated to open up and talk about Marissa or talk about her story and ask them if they had questions or ask them about their experiences. I would ask them who in your school is doing things wrong. You know, I mean, I would just, if you openly as an adult and a parent, if you openly talk about it with kids, then they're going to feel like it's okay to talk about it. You know.
And the reality is that if you're not, then the people at school are, so they're learning the wrong thing. So you better make sure they're getting the right information.
Yeah. So, I mean, I tell everybody, you know, you talk about it as soon as you think you need to be talking about it. I've had people approach me and ask me, you know, what age is appropriate? Well, if you're asking it, then you probably should at least talk about it a little bit, you know, talk about it age appropriate level, you know, but there's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong with opening up a door for your kids to be able to come to you to talk about things. Cause our situation is probably different, but I feel like TJ and I could probably talk about anything, you know, at any given time. And I feel like he's comfortable enough to come to me with any situation, you know, I'm open. I don't hide things. I don't, you know, I mean, I do hide some things, but, but for the most part, when it comes to, you know, addiction and drugs and alcohol and, you know, always telling him when he walks out the door, make good decisions, you know, think about it. Think about what you're doing before you do it.
Okay. All right. So you had one of the other pieces of information you had given me, and I didn't know this, is that there's a number you can call, right? 211?
211. Yeah. And it's for a lot of different things. It's for mental illness. It's for counseling. It's for addiction. It's for, you know, if you don't have a place to stay, you know, I mean, like, it's just, it's a good resource to have. And it's so easy to remember. So you can just get on there. What normally happens is they ask you, you know, where your area is or your location. And then they ask you what your problem is and they try to connect you with the right resources.
Yeah. Good. Excellent. Okay. Yeah. So 211. Okay. And just to reiterate, on my website, we're going to put your YouTube videos, a couple other links and some of this information. Anything else you want to say before we wrap this up?
No, I appreciate you so much. And I appreciate your advice over the years, you know, that you've helped me and, you know, the different things that you've said to me that I kind of ran with and, you know, looked up to you for. And then this platform that you have for people to be able to talk and talk openly, it's pretty great.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I'm humbled. I'm glad you came today. I know it was hard. I know you're excited, but I know it's still hard. And, And I'm sorry that you've gone through what you've gone through, you know.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I appreciate you. So.
Thank you.
Okay. It's getting emotional, so let's, again, it's always a pleasure. And, you know, if you need anything, please let me know.
All right, I will. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tony. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I want to thank you for joining us for episode today to hear Tony's story. Again, some of the resources that Tony discussed, I have made available on my website. It's www.thebradleyhall.com. Look forward on my blog. The name of the page is Tony and Marissa. Drug addiction is a serious problem in this country that has only gotten worse in recent decades. It's estimated that a record 25 million Americans age 12 or older have some sort of substance abuse problem. And the estimates are only that 1 in 7 actually receive treatment. If you or someone you know is dealing with some type of substance abuse issue, please seek help, whether it's through the information found on my website or plenty of other sites, or just through a friend. Please, please seek help. Take it seriously. Again, thank you for listening, and until next time, take care of yourself.